Hello and welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast 156. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around we're doing two versions of the same movie. First off, we have the 1939 Ernst Lubitsch classic, Ninotchka, starring Melvin Douglas and Greta Garbo, and then we go on to the 1957 iteration of the movie. It's the musical version Silk Stockings, starring Fred Astaire and Sid Charisse. Both of the movies have a lot going for them. One's more than the other in some ways, one's more than the other in other ways, but they're both really interesting films. So sit back, relax, I'll get the contact details out of the way, then I'll start talking movies. Paleo Cinema Podcast appears every 2 weeks and is a podcast of classic film appreciation. The rules are simple and two in number. Firstly, the movie has to be more than 20 years old, and secondly, I have to like it. Feedback is very important, so you can leave reviews on iTunes. You can email me at cultguru@gmail.com, that's cult with a K. Or you can head over to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. You can like the page there and add your 2 cents worth. Now, this podcast contains adult language and concepts, so enjoy it. How you doing? We're doing okay here. The world is moving as it moves. We've still got some warmth to the air, and that's kind of nice. I'm enjoying the last tail end of the warm weather, which I always appreciate very, very much. Some interesting things are happening at the moment, which is kind of cool as well. We've still got a conservative government in Australia, which sucks, of course. But there's a couple of things going on. But to tell you that, I'll talk a little bit about the movies I've been watching first, and then I'll roll in the interesting thing I'm going to be doing this week, which is quite a serious interesting thing, but nonetheless, it is an interesting thing. So what have I been watching? Actually, there's been a few things since the last time I podcasted, so that's a nice change from recent times when my movie viewing has slowed down a lot. I did see a short film, or shortish film, about an hour long, that Peter Capaldi did for the BBC a few years ago called Cricklewood Greats, and it's a kind of mockumentary about a fictitious British film studio called Cricklewood Films. And basically, it's a piss take on the history of British cinema. I mean, they take the Mickey out of Gracie Fields. They take the Mickey out of a whole bunch of other people. And the more you know about English film history, the funnier this movie is. There's some great little scenes, and it's a bit of fun. And I really enjoyed it. I believe it is out there via Uncle Torrent, so you might want to check that out. It's a nice little kind of movie buffs kind of comedy, which is always nice. It's nice when somebody bothers to target a movie to your demographic, and I enjoyed that. I did see a smallish 1960s movie starring George Peppard, Gene Seberg and Richard Kiley called Pendulum. It's about a cop whose unfaithful wife, played by Gene Seberg, gets killed. Don't worry, it's not a spoiler. And he has to find the guy who murdered her. Now, it's not particularly a fantastic film, but I kind of like, I like watching Gene Seberg in movies, and I like Richard Kiley as well. Richard Kiley is an actor who mostly played villains. He was the guy who, in Pick Up on South Street back in the 1950s, killed Thelma Ritter. So he's played the heroes and villains. He's got a beautiful resonant voice, and we kind of enjoyed it. It's a movie I hadn't seen before, so I watched that. I did watch Interstellar as well, the great big blockbustery Christopher Nolan film from recent times. And yeah, it's very interesting, very complex. I'm going to watch it again because I want to get more out of it. The science in it is pretty spectacular. The special effects are spectacular. And McConaughey doesn't piss me off the way he does in some films. So I watched that and kind of enjoyed it. I saw a really good documentary on Mums Mabley, made by Whoopi Goldberg. And now, Mums Mabley was a black female stand-up comedian, essentially, from the early to the mid part of the 20th century. And she had a political edge to what she did, but managed to get things past the arbiters of taste and good manners in some very interesting way. Jackie Mabley had a few things against her at the time in the middle of the 20th century. She was black, she was female, and she was a lesbian, but she never let any of that bother her, and she became very influential on a whole bunch of other comedians, male and female, who talk about her and her career in the documentary. Unfortunately, one of them is Bill Cosby, which kind of tarnishes the documentary somewhat, in the same way that if you see the Australian musical Brand New Day, they talk about liking Rolf Harris's music. But having said that, the Mums Mabley documentary is recommended. It's a piece of history that needed to be talked about, and a person of importance in entertainment who needed to have that recognition that the documentary rightly gives her. So I saw that. For the radio gig with Liz Travaskis up at ABC Local Radio Northern Territory, we had done Revenge of the Nerds, which we found sexist and horrible and didn't age well, and we just didn't like it, neither of us. So I thought we'd go with a campus comedy of the same era, around 1985, 1986, that does things right. And we went with, drum roll, Real Genius with Val Kilmer. And both of us enjoyed that. It was directed by Martha Coolidge, and it has that great big climax with the popcorn, which I always like. And it's got some cool science in it, and it talks about important issues at the time, the Strategic Defense Initiative in America, the Star Wars project, when they were planning to put death rays up in orbit so nobody would ever challenge American supremacy, which kind of, you know, didn't really work out as history told. But we both enjoyed that, and it was a nice palate cleanser after seeing Revenge of the Nerds and realizing that basically the nerds were sex offenders and would have been doing serious jail time in any reasonable society. So we watched that and really enjoyed it. Now, the serious thing I'm going to be doing soon is a part of the radio gig. Actually, I'll talk about that after I talk about the rest of the movies that I've seen lately, because some of them are worth checking out. I saw a kind of small-budget British crime drama from recent years called We Still Kill the Old Way, which stars Ian Ogilvy. It's a story of a London gangster who's retired to Spain, and his brother, played by Stephen Berkoff, breaks up a gang of young criminals who are raping a girl, basically. And they stab him and kill him and beat him up. And the brother comes back to London, gets the old gang together, these old hard-ass 60s and 70s, 70-year-old gangsters, and they go to war with a group of young 20-something drug-dealing gang. And it's not bad. It's not perfect. I think the budgetary limitations kind of make it less than it might have been otherwise. And there's talk of a sequel too, which could be interesting. But they've got Alison Doody, who people remember as the bad girl from one of the Indiana Jones movies, playing a police inspector. And unfortunately, the work she's had done on her face is pretty fucking obvious and pretty ick, really. And even though she acts fairly well, the damage she's done to the front of her head by having so many bits of work done really does kind of alienate you from the character. And that's probably something that Hollywood should take into account, and of course London, because this is set in London, in that really there's a point where with plastic surgery, whether it's a male or a female, and unfortunately it seems to affect females more often, where the bits and pieces you have done work against the career you want to have. Well, micro expressions are an important thing, and subconsciously human beings pick them up. Greta Garbo had terrific micro expressions. Her face told stories with minimal effort. But if you go and inject botulism into your face to paralyze nerves and stretch the skin and suck out the fat and redeposit it elsewhere around the eyes, and all that kind of stuff that gets done now in the name of ostensible beauty, it works against actors carrying out their art. And unfortunately, the case of someone like Alison Duty that happened. So, that's my little rant for the podcast. I'll probably find one or two others at some stage. I did see a very small budget and kind of B or C picture from the 1950s starring Peter Graves and Chuck Connors called Death in Small Doses. It's about an undercover cop who investigates amphetamine use among interstate truck drivers in America. And it's not too bad. It's got some nice moments and it's got Marla Powers in there as well and a few other people. But, it would have been really kind of ordinary, except for the fact that there's a nice twist at the end, which I've kind of predicted. But nonetheless, it's it does take it into film noir territory, and it's worth checking out if you get a chance to. There are a few different movies called Death in Small Doses, but this one's from about 1957, and I recommend it. Then I kind of went low rent and low budget, and on cable I saw a movie based on the computer game series, Halo, and that's Halo 4 Forward Unto Dawn, which kind of takes a whole bunch of recruits in the Halo universe, and they get attacked by aliens and shoot things up, and Master Chief comes and rescues them. They get to ride in a warthog, and if you haven't played the game, you won't know what a warthog is, and shoot some things, and they have a whole bunch of different kind of iconic weapons and aliens and alien types from the Halo series. It's kind of low budget, and it's there probably more than anything to promote the games, and there are at least six of them in the series so far. But because I've been playing Halo quite often of late, I thought I'd watch it, and I kind of got amused by it in a very low-key kind of way. Then I saw, apart from the two movies I'm talking about this time around, which I probably should mention, Ninotchka, starring Greta Garbo, and Silk Stocking, starring Fred Astaire and Saoirse Ronan. Apart from those two, there are two more things I watched which are kind of interesting. One of which is a low-budget 1960 British crime drama called Never Let Go, starring Richard Todd and Peter Sellers. It's about a kind of semi-unsuccessful travelling salesman who has his car pinched by a car theft ring and goes after them because he really needs a car back. He's not doing well at his job. His marriage is a little bit on the rocks. And so he goes up against a really nasty, mean, sadistic and sexually sadistic car dealer, garage owner, played by Peter Sellers in a dramatic role. Now, if you only know Peter Sellers from the Pink Panther and even being there, in this movie, he is a fucking stone killer. He's a nasty piece of work. He's a fucking psycho. So check out Never Let Go. I'm going to have to do it in a future podcast because playing against type, Peter Sellers really does bring a memorable and nasty villain. There's a great fight between him and Richard Todd in a garage at the end of the movie, which is really interesting and really kind of cool. In a lot of ways, it's very much a sleeper film, but it's kind of film noirish. It's definitely, you know, Brit crime, and does a nice job of it too. It also stars Adam Faith and Carol White and Elizabeth Sellers, but the main axis of everything is Richard Todd and Peter Sellers going head to head. And the cool thing about it is that Richard Todd's character isn't really likable. The protagonist in the movie is a guy who just can't get his shit together. And that makes things more interesting than if he was in America at the time. He would have been a virtuous kind of Gregory Peck kind of character who's more or less without flaw except for maybe one or two times. But this guy is someone that really can't get his shit together, has trouble holding a job, and desperately needs a car for that reason. And, it surprised me how good that film was. And I highly recommend Never Let Go. And I'm also halfway through watching a French animated movie of recent time called Le Magasin de Suicides, which is basically the suicide shop. And it's very early Tim Burton in feel. It's about a family who run a shop that sells people supplies so that they can commit suicide. And it's a musical as well. They got some songs in there. And the family are very happy with what they do. They assist suicides. They sell people ropes and poisons and poisonous fish and gases and other means of committing suicide. And the wife is pregnant. She has a child who turns out to be a happy-go-lucky kind of kid in this family of gloomy people who do things like sell razor blades for people to slit their wrists with, and one of the son's jobs is to make the razor blades even sharper. It's very dark and modern, but it's a lot of fun and quite charming. It's got a really nice visual style to it, and I recommend Le Magasin de Suicides, the Suicide Shop. It'll come up as if you search for it, which it's subtitled. It's in French. It's subtitled, but it's a bit of fun. I wouldn't show it to kids particularly, but if you're into that kind of early Tim Burton Nightmare Before Christmas kind of thing, it's definitely a film to go to. Okay, so now we talk about the serious thing we're going to be doing on the radio. The Australian of the Year at the moment is a woman called Rosie Batty, who got to be Australian of the Year through some very unusual circumstances. What happened was that the man who was the father of her son, Luke, and who had a lot of mental problems and drug abuse and other issues, about a year and a bit ago, had a visitation at a playground with his son and Rosie's son, and stabbed and beat the kid to death. Rosie Batty was interviewed by the media, of course. You know, she's the mother, grieving mother of a son that's been beaten to death by her ex, who was then shot by police and died. And she became, over the last 12 months, an incredibly eloquent and powerful representative of the victims of domestic violence. She really unflinchingly took it to power and said that there, and showed how many times she tried to get the police to interfere, how violence orders against this kind of violent man just don't work in a lot of cases, and how we need to have a national discussion and a national project and find a way in which to deal with issues of domestic violence a lot better than we are now. In Australia, about every week a woman dies at the hands of a partner. And so there's a great national discussion at the moment where people are telling their stories about their own experiences of domestic violence. Now, I put up a few tweets on Q&A, which is a political show that streams tweets down the bottom of the screen while the discussions are going on. I put a few tweets up about domestic violence. And then Liz Travascus, my friend from ABC Local Radio Northern Territory, emailed me and said, "Do you want to talk about your experiences of domestic violence when you were a child on the air?" Now, I thought about it. I talked it over with Sally. I talked it over with my sister, Linda, because it does involve my family history. And my mum, who's not well at the moment, can't really speak for herself. And so I agreed to do it. So next Thursday this week, I'm recording a half an hour about my experiences as a child of domestic violence, as a victim, and also as a witness to the domestic violence that was perpetrated against my mother, because people have to tell their stories. That this stuff has to get out there. We have to learn what it was like in my day, back in the 1960s, and why we need to have the protections we do have, and to enhance the protections that we do have, in order to kind of work on this as a national project and kind of get things happening to prevent nightmares, real life nightmares, happening to more people. What can we do about it? How can we defuse men before they get to that stage? How can we help women when they're in those circumstances? And it's an important project, and I've been asked by Liz to be a part of it and tell my story. And I'm going to do it. I'm a little apprehensive about it. It takes me back to places and memories that are incredibly unpleasant. But I do want to be a part of this. And so we're going to be having a chat about that during the week. I'm going to try to get an MP3 of it. And may well find a way to give it to people that are interested. Particularly, I want my family to have a copy of it. Because horrible though it is, nightmarish though it was, it is a part of our family history, and it is something that I'd like to keep. So that's it. That's what I'm going to be doing. I'll let you know how it goes next time around. But, yeah, it's something I wasn't expected to be doing because I tend to, in my radio work, stay at the shallow end of the pool, if you know what I mean. But I am going to be doing it, and I hope that it does kind of be a, it does become a part of the conversation that's happening around these issues in Australia. So, anyway, I'm going to take a break now, and when I get back, we're going to be talking about one of the best and funniest and most delightful movies Ernst Lubitsch made, and that is Ninotchka.
Up into the sky, I'll be here, I'll be there. You'll see my shadow everywhere. From the east to the west, take a ride with me, be my guest. Can you wait, can you stay, until the cat comes out to play? I'll be in seven places at a time. You're watching me leave as I arrive. Through the night, through the day, you can see me making my way. For my love can't be enough. For the goal, for the game, to the fire and into the flame. I will pass while you sleep, up to the sky and to the deep. For the sun, for the moon, from midnight into the noon. I will wait, I will stay, until the cat comes out to play. You can see me making my way, for my love can't be enough. For the goal, for the game, into the fire and into the flame. I will pass while you sleep, up to the sky and to the deep. For the sun, for the moon, from midnight into the noon. I will wait, I will stay, until the cat comes out to play. You know I will stay, until the cat comes out to play. You know I will stay, until the cat comes out to play.
That was Tom Gabel with The Cat. Tom Gabel's my new discovery as far as retro music is concerned. He's a German guy who does retro music, some original, some not original, and he looks like a minor villain in a 1960s crimi film. But Tom Gabel really rocks it out there, and I've been listening to a lot of his stuff, and it's very cool. A lot of it's on YouTube. It's spelled G-A-E-B-E-L, I think. And, yeah, he's my new favourite at the moment because I like the kind of retro orchestrations. They're a little bit Peter Thomas. Now, if you don't know who Peter Thomas is, he was a film composer in Germany, did a lot of work in the 60s and 70s. And, yeah, that's just cool stuff. I wonder if Armin likes Tom Gabel. Or maybe you've got a more modern taste in music, mate. But anyway, it's time to get on to the first of the films, even though I'm 25 minutes into the podcast. And that is Ninotchka, 1939 American comedy, directed by Ernst Lubitsch, the director for any kind of romantic comedy at the time. Stars Greta Garbo, and the tagline of the film was "Garbo Laughs." Melvin Douglas, Ina Clare. And it does have a small role in a non-horror context for Bela Lugosi playing a commissar in Russia, which is kind of cool. I mean, stepping out of your comfort zone is never a bad thing. But I'll just play a little bit of the wonderful dialogue, part of which was written by I.L. Diamond and Billy Wilder for Ninotchka. It was based on a story originally by Melchior Langer. And, yeah, I'll tell you what the plot of it is after I play this beautiful bit of kind of playful dialogue between Melvin Douglas and Greta Garbo. Actually, before I do that, I'll explain the plot. Now, the plot's a little bit complicated, but it does get simpler towards the end. It's between the wars, and three Russian commissars go to Paris to sell some jewelry that's left over from the aristocracy. Russia needs the money to buy tractors so that they can grow food. People are starving in Russia. And so these three commissars turn up in Russia. Now, the jewels are actually owned originally by Princess Swanya, played by Ina Clare, and she finds out that the jewels are there via a kind of a friend who's a butler in the hotel at which the commissars are staying, and I didn't explain that very well. And so they put a legal lien against the jewels and try to get them back for Princess Swanya, who is a vain, stupid, and selfish woman who needs the money as well, because princesses don't tend to do well once the countries they're princesses of go communist. And so her boyfriend, played in this case by Melvin Douglas, his name's Leon, decides to corrupt the three commissars and shows them the best of Paris. He teaches them about room service, about the wonderful food they've got there, how you can order cigarettes up to your room, and he teaches them as well about French maids. And so these guys are totally corrupted by the capitalist system. And so Russia, hearing about this and hearing about the legal lien against the jewels, sends another commissar to straighten things out. And this commissar is the person we learn as Ninotchka. They send a female commissar there. Now, Leon meets Ninotchka on the street accidentally. And they're both caught kind of on a busy street in between the policeman blowing the whistle to let them across the street, and they strike up this conversation there. It's quite funny, and I love the writing in this. I love the playfulness of the banter, and I love Ninotchka's seriousness, which is played beautifully. I mean, Greta Garbo in this film, apart from being ravishingly gorgeous and fantastically charismatic, plays the straight man for a lot of the movie and does it incredibly well.
You please.
Me?
Could you give me some information?
Well, gladly.
How long must we wait here?
Well, until the policeman blows his whistle again.
At what intervals does he whistle?
What?
How many minutes between the first and second whistle?
You know, that's very funny. I never thought of that before.
You've never been caught in a similar situation?
Yes, I have. Now that I come to think about it, it's staggering. Good heavens, if I add it all up, I must have spent years waiting for signals. Imagine, an important part of my life wasted between whistles.
In other words, you don't know?
No.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Can I be of any assistance to you?
You might hold this for me.
I'd love to.
Correct me if I'm wrong. We are facing north, aren't we?
Facing north? Well, now, I'd hate to commit myself without my compass. Pardon me, are you an explorer?
No, I'm looking for the Eiffel Tower.
Good heavens, is that thing lost again? Are you interested in a view?
I'm interested in the Eiffel Tower from a technical standpoint.
Technical? No, I'm afraid I couldn't be of much help from that angle. You see, a Parisian only goes to the tower in moments of despair to jump off.
How long does it take a man to land?
Now, isn't that too bad? The last time I jumped, I forgot to time it. Let me see now, the Eiffel Tower. Your finger, please.
Why do you need my finger?
It's bad manners to point with your own. There, the Eiffel Tower.
And where are we?
Where are we? Now, let me see, where are we? Ah, here we are. There you are, and here am I. Feel it?
I'm interested only in the shortest distance between these two points. Must you flirt?
Well, I don't have to, but I find it natural.
Suppress it.
I'll try.
For my own information, would you call your approach toward me typical of the local morale?
Mademoiselle, it is that approach which has made Paris what it is.
You're very sure of yourself, aren't you?
Well, nothing's happened recently to shake my self-confidence.
I have heard of the arrogant male in capitalistic society. It is having a superior earning power that makes you that way.
A Russian? I love Russians. Comrade, I've been fascinated by your five-year plan for the last 15 years.
Your type will soon be extinct.
Of course, a romance starts between Leon and Ninochka and doesn't go smoothly at all at times, but the interplay between the two characters is fantastic, and the point at which Ninochka finally kind of breaks down and becomes a human being rather than a commissar is quite amusing as well. The movie's basically a satire, not only on communism, and of course there's a lot to be satirical about there, but also on capitalism and also about Paris and the conceits that men and women have about themselves and about other people. So it's a very sophisticated thing, and that's part of what they call the Lubitsch touch. The way that Lubitsch tells the story, there's a great scene where you see the hotel room where the commissars are staying, and all you see is the feet of the people walking in and out and the satisfied noises coming from behind the door. So when the food gets delivered, you see the waiters walking in with the food and the satisfied noises of the commissars as they see this wonderful French cuisine. Then the maids come in with cigarettes, and you hear an even more satisfied sound, and one of the maids kind of staggers out a little bit, dishevelled, but with a smile on her face. So you get that kind of fun interplay in a Lubitsch film, which he manages to convey things indirectly, but with a great deal of style and with a beautiful humour to it. And that's what the Lubitsch touch is, the fact that he doesn't go straight forward and show and tell. He kind of obliquely draws you towards things. And really, yeah, I mean, it's done with such a sophisticated light touch that it's magic to watch. And once you've seen it, you realize that telling stories by film can be done any number of ways, and that this is one of the more sophisticated ones. And it's a lovely film as well. Greta Garbo was known before this as a great dramatic actress. She'd had a successful career. Movie she made before this was unsuccessful. The one she made after this was her last film and wasn't successful. Again, she did it with Melvin Douglas because they did have a great chemistry on the screen. They worked tremendously well. And she retired in the early 1940s, I think about 1941 from film, and moved to New York and became, they say she became a recluse, all through the 60s, 70s and 80s, there was Garbo spotting where they'd see this small woman with enormous sunglasses on walking the streets of New York, and that was Garbo spotting because people did see her. But that's not the story. She didn't become a recluse. She didn't turn into a hermit. She didn't turn into somebody who wore tissue boxes on their feet or anything like that. She travelled widely. She had a number of friends. She spent at some time at the Kennedy White House, for instance, back in the 1960s, and they found her a charming and erudite person. She was very outgoing. She did say she suffered from depression and was possibly a little bit bipolar, but her life after film was very fulfilling. She had a large number of very close friends and was incredibly well regarded by them as an intelligent, compassionate, and sophisticated woman. But, Ninochka, I like it for a lot of reasons. I like the three commissars as well, and they're really interesting characters in their own right. Played by some of the actors playing in this film were the same ones that were in Lubitsch's other film that I've talked about, which was To Be or Not To Be. You got Sig Ruman playing Irinov, you got Felix Bressart playing Bulyanov, and Alexander Granach playing Kapalsky. And they're great too. There's a kind of wide piece of Jewish humour in what they do as well, and the logic with which they approach the overwhelming capitalism of Paris in between the wars is a beautiful thing to watch. And these guys were stage actors and screen actors in Europe before the unpleasantness brought them to America. And their kind of craft is marvellous to watch. It's just good seeing these guys play off against each other and playing off against Greta Garbo and Melvin Douglas as well. Really kind of cool. Another actor that's in this movie briefly is George Tobias, who also turns up in Silk Stockings. In this one, he plays a Russian visa official who kind of stops Melvin Douglas from going to Paris to follow Ninotchka. George Tobias was in a number of things. He played Abner Kravitz in Bewitched in the 1960s. You might remember him from that. And he was also in a fun film that I've talked about on the podcast before, which was a kind of stage comedy that Warner Brothers did during the War for the War effort called Thank You, Lucky Stars, which has really cool things like Errol Flynn singing and Humphrey Bogart being torn a new one by Cuddle Sakal and all sorts of fun things like that. There's some really interesting pieces in that. And George Tobias is in there singing with Ida Lupino and somebody else as well. So really, he's one of those character actors whose face you recognise, and I like him a lot too. But overall, this movie is a joyous film in a lot of ways, and it is, as indeed is Silk Stockings. There's a kind of fun joyousness to it, even though there's the underlying seriousness of the problems Russia was experiencing at that time, and as we all know, are still experiencing in totally new iterations to this very day. But it's just incredibly charming and fun. And Greta Garbo she's not an actor that I've seen a lot of. I haven't seen Queen Christina and all those other films of hers. But I think I'm going to now, because she's very sexy for a start. There are some scenes in this where it's pretty obvious that she's not wearing a bra, and being a man, that's something that I do notice. But there's a kind of humour and a warmth to what she does, even when she's playing a serious, grim kind of character, which is delightful. It really does kind of take you out of your troubles, and you go, oh, Jesus, you know, wow. It's just, Greta Garbo, it was hot, and she was very talented, and there's some really great quotes about her. I found a couple of quotes about Greta Garbo, which I want to share, because I really like the way that they're phrased and exactly what they say about her craft as an actor. And they came from some sources that are really impressive in that way. And I'm just bringing those up on the screen now because I heard them. And I'm big on aphorisms. I like aphorisms. I like small pieces of text that really do encapsulate something. Betty Davis said about her instinct, her mastery over the machine was pure witchcraft. I cannot analyze this woman's acting. I only know that no one else is so effectively worked in front of a camera. And George Cukor said, she had a talent that a few actresses or actors possess. In close-ups, she gave the impression, the illusion of great movement. She would move her head just a little bit, and the whole screen would come alive like a strong breeze that made itself felt. And Ephraim Katz in the Film Encyclopedia said, of all the stars who have ever fired the imaginations of audiences, none have quite projected a magnetism and a mystique equal to Garbo's. The divine, the dream princess of eternity, the Sarah Bernhardt of films are only a few of the superlatives writers have used to describe her over the years. She played heroines that were at once sensual and pure, superficial and profound, suffering and hopeful, world-weary and life-inspiring. And yeah, I agree with all three of those quotes. It's a revelation to me to see Garbo in this, and I really do enjoy it. I like the way that Lubitsch plays with the pomposity of human endeavour, and the way that he kind of says that once people find their true nature, they're much happier. That's always an important lesson for anybody. But this film, I mean, not only is there Silk Stockings, which is a direct remake based on a Broadway musical of Ninotchka, but it's a story that was made by two much lesser films. There's a movie called Comrade X in 1940. It came out only a year after this one, done by MGM, the same studio. Comrade X, starring Clark Gable and Hedy Lamarr. Now, Hedy Lamarr we all know because part of her research as a scientist gave us Wi-Fi and Bluetooth. You might want to look that up. But and then in 1956, there's a much, much lesser film, which I've got a copy of, but I haven't seen yet, called The Iron Petticoat, starring Bob Hope and Katharine Hepburn. And both of those films, it says here in Wikipedia, borrowed heavily from Ninotchka, which shows how influential a film it is. I mean, if people start making various iterations of it a year later, it's got to be a successful movie. And if it's turned into a Broadway musical, it's got to be a successful movie. And you've got to remember that people talk about Lion King being made as a Broadway musical and other Disney things. It's not a new phenomenon. Silk Stockings, the Broadway musical, was in 1955. So Broadway's been doing this, borrowing from movies, way, way back. And, of course, it goes the other way around. Movies based on stage plays as well. There's a cross-pollination between Hollywood and Broadway that's been happening for well over half a century. But anyway, having said that, see Ninotchka if you haven't. If you haven't seen it for a while, go back and enjoy it, because you're going to forget the nuances of what Lubitsch does with it if you haven't seen the film in a while. And they're worth revisiting. If you want a movie to cheer you up, and I know a number of my friends and a number of listeners need that at the moment, this is definitely one of those. So go with it, enjoy it. And I'm going to take another break now. And when I get back, I'm going to be talking about the musical adaptation of Ninotchka, Silk Stockings, starring Fred Astaire and Sid Charisse, directed by Ruben Mamoulian, and with choreography by Hermes Pan.
I love the looks of you, the lure of you. I'd love to make a tour of you. The arms, the eyes, the mouth of you. The east, west, north, and the south of you. I'd love to gain complete control of you and handle even the heart and soul of you. So love at least a small percent of me do. For I love all of you.
That, of course, was a love theme to 50 Shades of Grey. No, it wasn't. It was actually Fred Astaire singing to Sid Charisse in Silk Stockings. The movie Silk Stockings started out as a stage play in 1955. With music, of course, by Cole Porter. It was written by George S. Kaufman, Lewin McGrath, and Abe Burrows. And it was a fairly popular musical at the time. Let me see who was in it, because I always like seeing who was in the original Broadway version of something that later on became a movie. And it's Hildegard Neff, a German film and stage actress, it says here, and Don Ameche, who'd never sung before, and Gretchen Weiler. Apparently, they blew it away. It was really great. George Tobias was in the stage version as well. He's the only person that came across from the stage version to the film version, and he appears in this one. And went on for 478 performances, which is kind of cool there. And this is a very different movie, of course, from the Lubitsch Ninotchka, even though it does tell the same story essentially. There are a few variations. Rather than having Leon, the aristocrat, you have Steve Canfield, played by Fred Astaire, who's a movie producer who's bringing his star over to Paris to make a movie based on War and Peace, which is one of the conceits in this movie. And she's played by Janice Page, who plays a character called Peggy Dayton, who's a movie star known for doing movies where she swims. So she's like Esther Williams. It's almost a piss take on Esther Williams. And there are some little bits of business with Janice Page where she's trying to do a serious role, but when she's just sitting around in idle moments, she'll kind of bash the side of her head like she's trying to get water out of her ears, which is kind of cool. And her and Fred Astaire have a song together, which is kind of cool and kind of appropriate for a movie-related podcast.
today to get the public to attend a picture show. It's not enough to advertise a famous star they know. If you want to get the crowds to come around, you gotta have glorious Technicolor, breathtaking CinemaScope, and stereophonic sound. If folks today could witness Valentino in the Chic, they never would appreciate this lover boy's technique. If you want to hear applauding hands resound, you gotta have glorious Technicolor, breathtaking CinemaScope, and stereophonic sound.
The customers don't like to see the groom embrace the bride unless her lips are scarlet and her mouth is 5 feet wide.
In glorious Technicolor, breathtaking CinemaScope, or
Cinerama,
VistaVision, or
SuperScope, or
Tadeo,
and stereophonic sound, and stereophonic sound.
They actually changed the lyric of that for the movie. The bit where he says that unless her lips are scarlet and her mouth is 4 feet wide, it's actually her bosom in the original stage production, so they took out the word bosom because this is the 1950s, and the 1950s sucked in a lot of ways. So this movie is fantastic. The choreography, of course, you've got Cole Porter doing the music. Your choreography by Hermes Pan, who worked with Fred Astaire on a lot of things and also did a whole bunch of other movies of the 1950s as well, including most of the choreography for Kiss Me Kate, which is another Cole Porter musical on the screen that I like. A little bit of the choreography for Kiss Me Kate was actually done by Bob Fosse, particularly the stuff he did with Carol Haney. But this movie has Fred Astaire and Sid Charisse dancing, and that's pretty much the best thing about the film. I love it for that reason. Fred Astaire was 58 at the time he made this movie. It was his second last movie musical. His last movie musical was done about 11 years later, and it was directed by none other than Francis Ford Coppola. And that was Finian's Rainbow, which is a miserable failure, mostly because it had Tommy Steele in it. But this one is a nice one to go out on. In fact, I really like this. I like the way Fred Astaire dances with Sid Charisse. He'd done it in a couple of other films previously, including The Bandwagon. And it's just, watching him is magic. I was kind of thinking through, there are comparisons that are always made between Fred Astaire and Gene Kelly. And the thing is, and they only, of course, ever did one movie scene together, which was for Ziegfeld Follies in the 1940s. But the comparisons are interesting as well. Gene Kelly came to dancing as an athlete. He'd been a high school and college athlete and came into dancing and came from a totally different tradition than Fred Astaire did. Gene Kelly learned tap dancing from a great black American dance teacher. He was a Francophile. He learned a lot of things from French ballet and things like that. And he had a much more muscular and overtly masculine kind of dancing than Fred Astaire did. Gene Kelly always did things like he'd dress in working class clothing. It'd be sailor shirts or t-shirts or something like that. He preferred that kind of thing, which kind of democratized dance in a lot of ways. Whereas Fred Astaire was always top hat, white ties and tails, because he'd started out in vaudeville as maybe a 5 or 6 year old dancing with his older sister Adele. And they were from a more kind of classy, ballroomy kind of thing. He could tap dance as well. He's a fantastic tap dancer as well. But they came from totally different traditions. And Gene Kelly was, you know, a dozen years younger than Fred Astaire, if not more, probably a little bit more. And just seeing the two of them dance together that one time in Ziegfeld Follies is marvelous. But I always like the comparisons because both of them make it look effortless. But it's kind of like, well, what's the comparison we could use? Gene Kelly was kind of like the Burt Lancaster of dancing. He had that overtly macho and masculine way of doing it, whereas Fred Astaire was much more smooth and flowing. I mean, he danced with hat racks, he danced with pieces of newspaper, he danced with all mops and all sorts of things like that. He could make any partner look good. Incredible perfectionist too. Each music number in any of the movies that Fred Astaire did had an initial rehearsal period, and then he took 2 more weeks of rehearsals to perfect it. He just did things marvelously. And there are a number of dance scenes that he does with Sid Charisse in this movie where it's just so flowing and does seem effortless. that it's magic to watch. It kind of gives you an idea of what human beings are capable of physically and artistically as well. It's just, I mean, of course, there are better Fred Astaire movies to see for this kind of thing, but I kind of watched, I wasn't going to actually do these two movies for the podcast. I'll tell you that up front. I was originally going to do two other films, and then the other morning I'd slept in. I had like 12 hours sleep to catch up, and I woke up and grabbed a cup of coffee and sat down in front of the TV and turned on TCM, and Silk Stockings was just starting. So I sat through it while I was kind of waking up and having breakfast. And watching Fred Astaire and Sid Charisse dance in this had me mesmerized. I was kind of half awake in some ways, but the magic of it just totally carried me away. And I love that. And in fact, there's also a scene I should mention in this film, which is even more impressive, which is the Silk Stockings dance that Sid Charisse does, where she wanders around the Paris apartment where she finds herself, and she's been wearing the kind of commissar grey clothing for the whole movie, playing Ninotchka, of course. And suddenly she reaches behind something and pulls out a pair of silk stockings and does almost a striptease, but it's more like a change of character, where she pulls out the stockings, she pulls out a corset, she pulls out other underwear, very feminine, very girly underwear, and dancing around behind the furniture and things like that, slowly changes into a new person in a lot of ways while dressing in this underwear. Of course, Sid Charisse didn't need a corset. She was stunningly beautiful and incredibly fit as well. But it's kind of like, whereas Fred Astaire's dancing in this movie is seductive, he's trying to seduce her into accepting a capitalist lifestyle and to keep the other commissars in France, and to kind of, yeah, bring her into enjoying her life. That's part of the seduction. Of course, the other part is a romantic seduction. But whereas his dancing is seductive, her dance with the silk stockings dance is more about discovering your true nature. It's very much a female dance, and it's still beautiful. She was a trained ballet dancer. She danced as a teenager for the Ballet Russe de Monte Carlo before the war. It was broken up by the war because a lot of the people involved in the Ballet Russe de Monte Carlo were Jewish and fled the country. And but she'd been as a teenager and had done a bunch of other jobs before getting into movies and doing dancing as a movie. She wasn't a particularly gifted actor, even though she was nominated for a Golden Globe Award for this role. There are some really cruel but not entirely untrue things said about Sid Charisse's acting. I'll just get them for you, because one of them particularly tickled me in a mean-spirited kind of way. It was actually one of my favourite movie reviewers of all time, Pauline Kael, who said this. She was talking about Sid Charisse dancing with Fred Astaire in the Dancing in the Dark and the Girl Hunt ballet routine in The Bandwagon. She said, "When the bespangled Charisse wraps her phenomenal legs around Astaire, she can be forgiven everything, even her three-minute classical ballet and the fact that she reads her lines as if she learned them phonetically." And that's not untrue. Sid Charisse wasn't a particularly gifted actor. She's in one of my favourite movies of all time, 2 Weeks in Another Town, where she plays Carlotta, the ex-wife of Jack Andrus, played by Kirk Douglas. And she's not too bad in that, but she later went on to do all sorts of weird and wonderful little bits of movies. She was in Warlords of Atlantis, playing a Queen of Atlantis, for instance, in 1978, which is actually the first movie I remember seeing her in. And she has a costume that kind of has stockings, and it's basically a body stocking costume. And even at that age, in 1978, she would have been, let me just crunch the numbers, 58, 59. She still looked pretty good in those days. But Sid Charisse was mostly a dancer, and her voice was dubbed in Silk Stockings, of course, because that's the way Hollywood went. I've seen a YouTube video of her doing some of her singing in her own voice for the movie, and to be honest with you, it's really not that bad. It's not quite up to MGM musical levels, but it's not an unpleasant voice, and I think she really did try to sing well enough to do the job, but that, of course, wasn't the case. But yeah, her voice was dubbed for the movie. But having said that, she is quite memorable in it, and she does have some of the same lines that Greta Garbo had when in Ninotchka, and puts them across kind of well. If I hadn't seen Ninotchka, I wouldn't have minded the way Sidgeri's played this role. But having seen somebody as gifted and magical as Greta Garbo play the role, it's kind of difficult to kind of say nice things about Sidgeri's in it, which is a bit of a shame, because as far as the dancing thing, which of course was her forte, she is transcendent in this movie, as indeed is Fred Astaire. Watching Fred Astaire dance is something you could do for hours and hours and not get bored with. There should be a supercut somewhere of every Fred Astaire dance sequence in every movie ever. Someone work on that. Because I would sit down and watch that YouTube video until I needed to go to the toilet. Really, Fred Astaire is that good. Even at the age of 58, there are some bits he does with various bits of equipment in a movie studio in one of the dance sequences in this film, which are incredibly athletic. And also the stereophonic sound sequence he does with Janice Page has some quite advanced athletic kind of movements that he has to do, which for a guy of that age shows that Fred Astaire was in incredible shape and incredibly talented as well. But I like this film a lot. I don't think it's particularly my favourite Cole Porter musical. Probably Kiss Me, Kate is, because I like the fact that it's got Bob Fosse in it, the Howard Keel thing, the fact that they've adapted it from Shakespeare and made it into fun and accessible and all that kind of thing. But this is still a nice film, and if you're going to have a musical version of Ninotchka, this is definitely not a shabby thing at all. And the other thing I've got to mention in the film, I forgot totally about this until just this very moment. Peter Lorre's in it. Remember how I said Bela Lugosi was in Ninotchka? Peter Lorre plays Brankov, one of the three commissars in this movie. And there are scenes when everybody else, who's more or less a dancer, is dancing around him. There's a scene with three showgirls in it, one of whom is Barry Chase, a stunningly attractive and very gifted dancer who later on went on to do TV specials with Fred Astaire as his dance partner in the 1960s. So she's in there wearing a gold lamé dress that seems to be sprayed on. And Peter Lorre can't dance. I mean, Peter Lorre's a short little painkiller addicted guy called Laszlo Lowenstein. And so what he does instead is he tucks two chairs under his armpits, lifts up his legs, and Russian dances holding onto these two chairs. And if you have a look in the sequence when he does that, behind everybody else dancing, Peter Lorre falls over and one of the chairs falls over, and he gets back up and does it again. So it's really hilarious to watch that. In that scene, watch it twice, wind it back, but watch it once for the stunning dancing, including Barry Chase, who was an incredibly attractive woman and a very gifted dancer. And then watch it again to see Peter Lorre's little bits of business in the background, which are incredibly amusing. Now, this was his first overtly comic role. He did do a nice little character piece in a 1936 Hitchcock film called Secret Agent, which starred John Gielgud and Michael Redgrave, where he plays a character called the Mexican Hit, the General, who is one of the spies in the movie. So he has a kind of slyly humorous role there. But this is his first overtly comical role. And he was a talented actor. I mean, his life wasn't particularly a happy one. He did have painkiller addictions and things like that. But he started out on stage and in Vienna and done Brecht in the 1920s and all that kind of thing. So he had chops. And then, of course, Fritz Lang got him in to play Hans Beckett in M. And he did Mad Love and all those kind of things and moved on to horror stuff. But in this one, it's great to see him do comic stuff. And the unfortunate thing is that he didn't get more screen time. I would have liked him to have screen time. He was actually morphine addicted is what his problem was. He had chronic gallbladder problems and he was prescribed morphine for it. And of course that led to an addiction which terminated his life fairly early. He only lived 60 years. But I like him in this movie. It's It's a cool little role and it's a cool cameo, and I'm glad they got the opportunity to do this. Now, the movie was directed by Ruben Mamoulian, who directed The Frederick March, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, amongst other things. Didn't make a lot of films, but he was an interesting director. And you can see in a couple of scenes where he's trying to emulate slightly, and not entirely successfully, Ernst Lubitsch by showing things indirectly. Now, this being an MGM musical, he doesn't get a lot of opportunity to play around the way Lubitsch did, of course, many years before. But it's nice to see him do that, and he does an honourable job on it. He only made... This was his last completed movie that Mamoulian made as director. He had a couple of other films which had taken away from him subsequent to this. But this is his last fully one. And it's not a bad place to end for a career. It's a good, honourable little movie. And, I just like this film a lot. I had the soundtrack on vinyl for like 30 years. I dragged it out about a year ago and played it. And the soundtrack's a lot of fun. Cole Porter, you've got to give a lot of credit to Cole Porter. He was probably the most playful songwriter of the 20th century. He skirted around censorship. He'd play with words and rhymes and ideas, and also do serious songs as well. So, again, another person who, because of his experiences in life, including a horse riding accident that crippled him, he's all seemed lovely. You know how it goes. But I really like Cole Porter's music, and there's been nobody quite like him since. So everything's come together. You've got Fred Astaire, fantastic dancer, and a reasonable singer. I like his light tenor voice. He puts a song across incredibly well as well. You've got Peter Lorre in there. You've got Sid Charisse. You've got a whole bunch of other people. You've got Ruben Mamoulian directing. You've got Hermes Pan's choreography. And it's kind of that last heyday of the MGM musical. It wasn't financially successful at the time. It's very popular now, and it's talked about by a lot of people. But like a lot of these films that you talk about in something like Paleo Cinema, it really didn't get a lot of love at the time it came out. It was unsuccessful. And not quite as unsuccessful, of course, as Finian's Rainbow was 11 years later, which is Astaire's last musical. But still, I like it. It's one of those ones whenever it's on TV, I'll sit down and at least watch part of it, if not all of it. And I just really do appreciate this film, not as much as I appreciate seeing Ninotchka for the first time yesterday. But nonetheless, I really do like the film a lot, and I do highly recommend it. So I'm going to take another break to rest my throat now, and when I get back, I've got a bit of feedback.
A beat when I see them walking down the street, and I wish they'd stop just to say hello. They keep walking on, humming just a happy little song, while their bodies sway and to and fro. The girls from Paramaribo enchant you with just a glance. The girls from Paramaribo, they make you long for romance.
That's another bit of Tom Gabel with is My Heart Skips a Beat, also known as The Girls of Paramaribo, which is kind of cool and has a very jet-setty 1965 about it. The feedback I got is from my old coffee-drinking buddy Morris from Love That Album podcast, amongst others, and Morris kind of gave me a little of a head start by sending me an email before I did the All That Jazz episode, but this is kind of cool. Hey Terry, I'm looking forward to hear what you have to say about All That Jazz on Paleo Cinema. I saw it when it first came out in the cinema. I think I would have been 12 or 13 years old, and it completely blew my mind. At the time, I'd only seen Roy Scheider in Jaws and was not prepared for his role in this film. I think what I appreciated most about it at the time was a demonstration that films didn't always have to have a traditional narrative of character establishment, conflict creator, conflict resolve, consecutive timeline. His discussions with Jessica Lange, probably the most beautiful representation of death in a film, though I didn't pick up on who she was until late in the film. I love the world Bob Fosse creates. Scheider's character cannot exist in the ordinary world. He's been a poor father and husband. He does whatever it takes in the ordinary world to keep him going back to the theatrical world. It's his point of reference. While in a coma, he choreographs his own death as a huge song and dance number, nothing less. So a film that should be quite dull because of a subject matter, never gets depressing. Obviously, it can hardly be life-affirming as Scheider struggles to make his way through the ordinary things in life demanded of him when he wants to focus on the artistic, yet the film definitely has a vibrancy. He definitely failed people, the three women in his life particularly, and yet he's far from being a terrible person. If Scheider's character is supposed to be based on Bob Fosse himself, and imagine the mindset of a man directing a representation of himself, viewing his choreographed death, this would explain why his character is really well developed, not a stereotype representation of a Broadway director. The move from scene to scene does not show a chronological tale, more like the final weeks in this guy's life told in a series of set pieces. It could have potentially been a mess, but it's not. It works really well, and I'm a huge fan. I look forward to your thoughts. Cheers, Morris. Yeah, it definitely was an autobiography. It was his Otto e mezzo, his 8.5, and it really does show that Bob Fosse was a man of incredible imagination and was willing to kind of dive deep into his own flaws to get what he needed to make a movie. And I like that. It's just one of those great films of its time, and shows that Bob Fosse dying when he did, which is still fairly early in his life, was a great loss to filmmaking. And had he survived longer, he might have hit the 90s when indie films started coming in, and he may have given us a few more really interesting films, but unfortunately that wasn't to happen. But thanks for that, Morris. I've also got some feedback for Martian Driving podcast from you, so I will play that next week when I do Martian Driving. So that's about it for this time around. We've looked at Russian people being seduced by decadent capitalists this time. I've told you what I'm going to be doing on the radio, which is very scary and challenging for me. And I'll let you know how it went next time around. So in the meantime, the Patreon campaign is still going. We need subscribers, so a few more of them wouldn't hurt. And I'm turning around right now and looking at the box full of stuff that I've got to give away to one lucky subscriber in April, which is only next month. So if people go to patreon.com/paleocinema, you can still get in and chuck in a micropayment and be eligible for me to send this box of movie and a little bit of television related stuff that I've got to you with my blessing. So as usual, the credits are in the style of movie credits, giving each of the Patreon subscribers a role in the Paleo Cinema movie. I'll see you guys in a week if you listen to Martian Driving, 2 weeks if it's Paleo Cinema. Take care of yourselves in the meantime. Again, thanks to all of the lovely people who support the podcast through the Patreon campaign. And as usual, in the manner of movie credits, here are their names and their jobs in the mythical Paleo Cinema Martian Drive-In movie. Thank you to Alyssa the Location Scout, Tansy the Foley Artist, Miss Jane the Wardrobe Mistress, Christopher the Gaffer, Chris the Camera Operator, Julia the Casting Director, Elaine the Scientific Advisor, Matt the Rattlesnake Wrangler, Armin the Key Grip, Jan the Dialect Coach, Morris the Musical Director, Gary the Prop Master, Tom the Focus Puller, Sarah the Special Effects Technician, Ian the Caterer, Grant the Technicolor Consultant, and our newest supporter, Claire the Script Doctor. So thank you very much to all of those people, and if you'd like to join them on the credits, go to patreon.com/paleocinema. I'd also like to thank Sally, who is the assistant to Mr. Frost and his muse, and also to Mr. Debussy for playing his music, The Gollywog's Cakewalk. I'll see you all again soon.